This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, August 13th, 2015. It's the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The numbers may not tell the story. That's something we often get reminded of on this program. The numbers tell only a general story. The destruction of Katrina, the rebuilding of New Orleans, the growth of China as it struggles to make a credible government. In the case of New Orleans, the numbers tell a story of a general rebound in a city that takes bad news in stride. In China, the story is growth that overwhelms everything and is transforming a nation virtually overnight. New Orleans has music, and there the story told is human, it's universal, and where the numbers just keep time. Later this hour, musician John Cleary holding on to the music when all is lost. In the case of China, though, the country has cash and credit and a willing world looking to lend money and invest in China. By the numbers, it's a miracle. But the miracle only works in a world flush with cash and credit and a Chinese political system that can grant freedom as easily as it writes checks. Author Will Hutton sounded a warning in his book last decade, The Writing on the Wall, China and the West in the 21st Century. China can't just float on the oceans of cash and credit in a booming world without significant political reform, he says. Now, high levels of poorly made exports, little homegrown technical innovation, a demanding and rising middle class, and the near absence of traditional rule of law that permits resources to be siphoned off in vast corruption schemes threatens everything in China right now. China's currency woes, worker unrest, slowing investment. This week, it reached a head with the devaluation of the Chinese yuan twice. Author Will Hutton, relying on some explosive metaphors, says he can't help but believe his predictions may be coming true.
There's two worries. One is a technical worry about the pace of economic growth, the fact that exports have slowed down, which has always been a major engine of Chinese growth. But beneath that, there's a deeper worry, which is that the Chinese leadership is kind of publicly acknowledging what it privately knows, which is that the Chinese economy is profoundly dysfunctional and getting into deeper and deeper trouble on multiple levels.
And let's talk about some of those levels. I mean, if we can liken cash to water and liken demand in the rising middle class in China to a thirst, is there enough cash in the world to deal with the demands of this growing middle class in China and the political instability if those demands are not met?
That's one way of opposing the question. And that presupposes that the economy is going to carry on growing. But actually, if you look at the underlying numbers, investment, private investment, insofar as there is such a thing as private investment, because everything in China is degrees of governmental. But actually, the big corporations and the so-called Chinese private sector, business investment is actually flat year on year. And that is the first time that's happened ever since the reform program began in the late 1970s. And public investment is not growing very much either. So, what sits behind your question is that the engine that has produced this growing Chinese middle class is carrying on uninterruptedly into the future. And that's what I would challenge. I don't think that the Chinese economic model, as it's been organized for the last generation, great dependence on export growth, great dependence on investment, keeping consumption growing at a much, much lower rate, is sustainable anymore. Over and above that, you have deep, deep set corruption. Over and above that, you have a financial system, as the recent collapse in the stock market showed, that is incredibly fragile. This is a volcano preparing to blow. No one can tell where that's going to happen in the next kind of 3 months or 3 years, but you can see the storm warnings of that happening.
And if we're going to look at this as a tripod, to use another tortured analogy, the leg of exports is weak and declining. The leg of investment, as you've just said, is flat and in a very, very precarious position right there. And the leg of consumption is also threatened by all of the things you've described, including corruption. I mean, are we closer than we think to this blowing of the volcano?
I mean, I wrote my book on this subject kind of some years back, around 2007, 2008. And what I thought was at the time that actually in the second half of the 2010s, that the Chinese economy would blow because the kind of inconsistencies and contradictions in it were just kind of not sustainable. You couldn't have exports carrying on growing at 25 to 30% per annum, because ultimately Chinese exports would swamp the planet. It was a completely impossible proposition. Nor could you carry on investing at these gargantuanly high rates where more than two-fifths of GDP was being consecrated to investment. I mean, roads going nowhere, railways going nowhere, viaducts carrying nobody over nothing. I mean, this was what was happening in China. And you can only get consumption up. And this is really important point for your kind of listeners to get hold of. You can only get consumption up if you allow people property rights, if you allow people the freedom to borrow in the way that you can do in the United States and in Western Europe. You can't do that in China for one enormously important reason. It actually enfranchises economically the middle class and would lead direct to a political challenge to the one-party system. And this kind of conundrum has been at the heart of Chinese politics, has been at the heart of the concerns of the Chinese leadership for more than a decade. And you can now start to see it surfacing.
Are we looking at a situation where if consumption stalls, that corporations that are looking for investments and can't find them in China are going to send their capital outside of China, and that the government's going to have that to deal with? And I'm wondering if the monetary policy in Europe and the United States, this whole quantitative easing business, is dependent on a lot of assumptions in China that look really suspect right now.
Completely correct. There's lots and lots of bits of the world economy that are held together by kind of gossamer thin threads. And one of those gossamer thin threads is the Chinese economy carries on growing. The Chinese economy carries on sucking in imports. I mean, you can already see in kind of what's happened to raw material prices around the world, you know, the slowdown of the Chinese economy, the impact it's having on commodity prices, you know. And as for capital flows, I mean, to tell the truth, no one really, you know, understands the complexity and interactions of these. But broadly speaking, the United States has needed China to hold its debt. And China has only been able to manage to do that because it's been a public holder of America's debt. Private citizens and private corporations in China have very, very limited capacity to get their money out of China. This whole system is enormously vulnerable. I mean, if the Chinese were to relax capital controls more than they have, the renminbi would fall even further quickly because people would ship their money out of this highly precarious, politically unstable place. Where would they ship it to? The United States. What would happen to the dollar? It would go up. What would happen to domestic American politics the night of the presidential elections? A lot of incredible pressure, particularly, well, from both Republicans and Democrats, because this would mean, you know, blue-collar America under even more pressure. So, you know, this is dangerous, dangerous times we're living through.
So you look out your window, you see the smoke rising over a mountain, you know a volcano has erupted. What are the signs here? The dollar spikes upward, the interest rates begin to change erratically, and a company like Boeing gets, $3 billion, $4 billion worth of orders canceled suddenly from China of airplanes.
All that you have described, I mean, it's not, I mean, lava isn't flowing from this volcano yet, but you can see actually the kind of earth tremors, and you can see to stretch this to another tortured analogy, you know, smoke puffing out of the top of the cone of it. I mean, you can see where the pressure points are coming. The red back, the renminbi, is going to fall in value. The green back, the dollar, is going to rise in value. That may defer some of the interest rate increases that the Fed has been talking about. But actually, the bigger impact will be on kind of cheap imports from China, once again putting pressure on blue-collar America. And actually, as you've described, some key orders from China that they've been deploying to compensate the United States for this trade deficit you run with China. Some of those may be canceled or not come through. And all of that is going to make the kind of politics between these two gigantic supercontinental superpowers begin to get very toxic.
All right. Who thinks you're nuts, as you describe this scenario that's causing the hairs on the back of my neck to stand up?
look, even the people who are kind of China optimists, you know, understand the points I make. They've always thought that the party was clever enough to kind of manage its way through these issues. I don't think anybody on earth is clever enough to manage the way through the kind of issues that China has currently got. All I can say is this. We have to watch this like a hawk. We have to handle it with great care. We have to understand the political arguments in China. And one thing that we must not do is to kind of to believe anyone who thinks that this economy is as strong as that of the United States. Its financial system is far weaker than the American financial system was in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. Arguably, it's in the same kind of order of weakness as in 1929. There are enormous kind of loans by the banks out to people who've been speculating on the stock market. There's enormous bad debts to municipal authorities. There's enormous bad debts to small and medium-sized business who've been given loans on political and not commercial criteria for decades. All this threatens to unravel in the years ahead, and everybody should be aware of that.
William Hutton is author of The Writing on the Wall, China and the West in the 21st Century. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
In our continuing mission to understand how ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, manages to govern, hold territory, and fund its operations, we focus on how ISIS has created a kind of currency in captured women. A few weeks ago, a terrifying Frontline documentary showed us how women from the Yazidi minority in Iraq are captured, auctioned off, and in some cases rescued by a heroic group of lawyers and activists. Today, a look at how this system of sex slavery works and the impact it has had on thousands of young women. ISIS has implemented a deeply rooted and developed infrastructure of sex slavery involving the females and the religious minority of the Yazidis. And community leaders estimate that more than 3,000 Yazidis are still being held captive by the group. Rukmini Kalamaki is foreign correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. She's conducted interviews with 21 women and girls who recently escaped from the throes of the Islamic State as part of her recent reporting. Rukmini, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, John.
We use the term infrastructure. How does that look to you from your perspective?
Yes, one of the surprising things that I learned here in Iraq when I was interviewing these women is that ISIS has essentially created a bureaucracy of slavery. Women who are taken captive are bought and sold by fighters. At the moment of the purchase, there's a contract, and the contract is in fact notarized by an Islamic State-run court. Then further to that, when a woman is freed, and there have been some that have actually been freed by ISIS fighters themselves, they are given what they call an emancipation certificate. It really reminds you of what we used to see, you know, in America in the 1800s in the South, where a person could become a freed slave and would essentially have a document stating that.
But as someone carrying around an emancipation certificate, I can't imagine one can then rejoin normal life in any significant way.
I spoke to one woman who was freed by her Libyan slave master. And the reason she was freed is he was a suicide bomber. He was about to go and blow himself up. And there is Islamic scripture that states that it is virtuous to free a slave. So knowing that he was about to die, he gave her the certificate. It did allow her to cross all of the checkpoints from very deep inside rural Syria all the way back to Iraq. However, the last checkpoint, which would have taken her to safety, is one that she would not have been able to cross. But at least from there, she had enough freedom of movement and she was able to go to a shop, buy herself a phone, call her family, and they then paid for a smuggler to get her the rest of the way to safety.
Aside from the deep emotional scarring from something like this that we'll talk about in a moment, do women with emancipation certificates have an ability to start a family, to be viewed as potential mates in the same way that other women who had not had this slave experience would be?
The certificate that she had stated in Arabic that she now has the status of a Muslim woman with all of the duties and responsibilities that come with that status under Sharia law. So obviously she now can behave as a Muslim woman under ISIS's, you know, definition of that, which is still a very restrictive status. She is able to marry a man who is then allowed to marry at least three other women, and he is also allowed to have Yazidi sex slaves. So what we're seeing is the very few women that have been given this emancipation certificate, they're not hanging around, you know, to see what life in the caliphate is really like. You know, they're using that as a way to get out of Dodge.
All right. Well, that's bizarre enough right there. It sounds as though the ISIS military is using this sex slavery infrastructure as a way of enforcing a kind of morale booster for fighters, a way of supporting them, a sort of benefits program. I don't quite understand.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's really sick about it. Several of the women told me that, you know, they would be present when their owner would be having phone conversations with other fighters who they gathered from the tone of the conversation were not in country. They were abroad. And the gist of the conversation was, you come to the caliphate, you can have women for cheap, you can buy beautiful women from this Yazidi ethnic group. And I think that's particularly appealing to men, for example, from Gulf countries, who come from a very conservative society where dating is taboo and where casual sex is essentially forbidden, and where marriage is also off bounds to people who don't have a lot of means. Because in order to marry, you have to be able to, you know, pay a dowry, provide for your family, buy, you know, have a house. And so within those strictures, you can see how this system, where you can come and essentially buy a poor girl for very little, would be a bonus.
Enough about the system. The women that you interviewed, how are they feeling? What is their state of mind? What do you think is the long-term consequence of this terrible experience?
You know, I have to say, John, it's been a really long time since I've done interviews that have been this dark. It's absolutely crushing what has happened to them. They were treated like, you know, I don't even want to say animals. Animals are not treated this way. They were treated like nothing. And the fact that there is a theological justification for what was done to them is, I think, what they and I, you know, find most disturbing about this. They were told over and over again, what we are doing to you is halal. What we are doing to you is allowed, and it's not just allowed, but it is seen as virtuous and good in the eyes of God.
Finally, do these, you know, morbidly creative folks at ISIS have a name for this infrastructure?
Well, they're using an entire lexicon around it, and they're using very old words. Sabia is an archaic word that means slave. And the women talk about how they were grabbed on the mountain, on Sinjar Mountain, as they were trying to flee last August 3rd. And immediately the women and the men were separated from each other. And very soon after, older women and young women are also cleaved and separated. They brought fleets of buses with them. So the women realized right away that these people were planning to transport them somewhere. And they were then taken to essentially a set of holding pens in Iraq, especially in the city of Mosul. And very soon after, ISIS officials came in, and they began hearing the word Sabia. Sabaya is the plural of it. And these were words that, even though these young women are Arabic speakers, they didn't know. And they all describe this moment, this chilling moment, this really horrifying moment when they finally realize what this word means, that it means slave, and that they have become enslaved.
Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
John, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Among the 2016 presidential candidates, there is a rather abstract discussion of a looming war. For Marco Rubio, it's a warning about Iran attacking the United States.
If they become a nuclear power, they can place a nuclear warhead on a long-range missile capable of reaching the United States.
NBC's Meet the Press heard those warnings from Senator Rubio last weekend, and it was Democrat Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation on CBS, although for him, it's no nuclear deal with Iran that brings the threat of war.
The alternative of not reaching an agreement, you know what it is? It's war. Do we really want another war, a war with Iran?
Gary Seymour was once President Obama's coordinator for weapons of mass destruction, counterterrorism, and arms control, but he was skeptical enough about Iran's trustworthiness on nuclear issues to become president of United Against a Nuclear Iran, a bipartisan advocacy group that's leading the fight against the Iran deal right now. Now Seymour has stepped down from that group. Gary Seymour, are you all over the map on this issue? Are you agonizing about something where the stakes couldn't be higher? You've seen both sides. Where do you stand now?
Well, I continue to be very skeptical of Iran, but I think that the nuclear agreement that's been negotiated presents the best option we have available to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, or at least delay that possibility for a reasonable period of time.
Can you assess the rhetoric from the campaign? Marco Rubio's suggestion that Iran will develop a nuclear weapon eventually and attack the United States, or Bernie Sanders' suggestion that no deal would mean there would be a war?
Well, it's typical in Washington that when you have these kinds of polarized debates, especially in the context of a presidential election, both the opponents and the supporters of the agreement, I think, are exaggerating the situation. This deal is a mixture. It has some positive elements. It has some negative elements. As I said, I think on balance, it's the best approach we have available. And so, therefore, I'm supporting it. But, you know, Iran is many, many years away from having any kind of a capability to directly threaten the United States with nuclear weapons. And if Congress overrules this deal, I don't think it makes war certain.
What do you say about the strategy of the group United Against a Nuclear Iran? Are they making a political play here, sort of mobilizing Israeli support to produce a constituency in Washington that will shoot down this deal and maybe have other sort of pro-Israel provisions on its agenda? What do you think they're doing here, and what's wrong with it?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with it. They genuinely believe that this agreement is not good enough, and they believe that we should go back to the negotiating table and try to get a better agreement. I'm skeptical that that's a practical option, at least in the near term. I think if we reject the agreement, we would probably take years to have to reassemble the sanctions pressure, and perhaps that would ultimately force Iran back to the bargaining table. But in the meantime, Iran will have advanced its nuclear program, increased the number of centrifuges and its stockpile of nuclear material, and I think it will be even harder to roll that back. So in my view, the deal that we have available, with all of its strengths and weaknesses, is preferable to the risk of rejecting it and trying to get a better agreement. But that's just a difference in judgment between my view and the view of the people at Ioanni.
I think we all would certainly allow everyone to express their opinion on this, and that the reasonable people in good faith can disagree. But my concern about United Against a Nuclear Iran, it's purely my concern, and it's a bit of a rhetorical concern or a problem with logic, and I wonder if you could address it with me. My sense is that United Against a Nuclear Iran would accept no deal of any kind. That essentially, their position logically and philosophically is that Iran can never be permitted to join any kind of international community. And I'm just wondering if that's, number one, true, and number two, if that's ever sustainable.
I don't think it's true. I think United Against Nuclear Iran would accept a deal if it met their conditions. Now, I think for some of them, the conditions that they are seeking are probably not attainable, given the leverage that we have available against Iran. You know, for example, some people have talked about anytime, anywhere challenge inspections, or dismantlement of Iran's nuclear capability, or unlimited duration of restrictions. As much as I would love to see those, I think they're probably not negotiable given the leverage that we have against Iran. And in my view, in the absence of a military ultimatum, probably not something we can force Iran to accept.
Could those conditions be met with anything short of an invasion of Iran?
Well, I think if the United States was prepared to issue a military ultimatum, we could obviously get a much better deal because we have such military superiority over Iran. They're a very weak country compared to the United States. But the U.S. is not prepared to issue a military ultimatum. Neither President Bush nor President Obama was prepared to make an explicit military threat in order to force Iran to make nuclear concessions.
So is Bernie Sanders right to meet the conditions of Yuani that you'd have to have some kind of a war?
Well, or threat of war. I mean, I think if the threat was credible, there's at least a reasonable chance that the Iranians would make more concessions. But the risk, of course, if you make a military ultimatum, you have to be prepared to back it up if the Iranians reject it. And that's a huge gamble. And I don't think the United States is prepared to use military force to compel Iran to make nuclear concessions. I think we would probably use military force to stop Iran if they were moving directly toward a nuclear weapon, but the Iranians have been very careful to avoid taking provocative action that they think could trigger an American attack. So I think to some extent the threat of U.S. military force has acted as a deterrent. It's constrained Iran's nuclear program, but that's different than using a military threat to compel Iran to make nuclear concessions. That's a step that, as I say, the last two presidents have not been willing to use.
Gary Samore, thanks so much for your candor.
Thank you, John.
Gary Samore is research director at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
Support for PRI's The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
John Cleary knows just how musical the idea of resilience is.
Bringing back the home of the greatest gift America gave the world. Jazz, funk, rhythm, and blues, and soul.
Piano and singer-songwriter John Cleary has heard and played the traditional music of old New Orleans for decades. It's a city he moved to from Kent, England at the age of 17. He also plays the music of the new city that New Orleans has become 10 years after the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. New Orleans, this land of tradition, also knows change, he says. It knows that nothing ever lasts. Great loves come and go. The seasons change. Even Katrina sculpted a city still vibrant and dysfunctional. A city still singing.
The city of New Orleans is the home of jazz, funk, rhythm, and blues, and soul. Shot back beat, second line city street, sound of a big bass drum. The greatest gift, talking about jazz.
Some of the older figures from the rhythm and blues days of the 40s and 50s are gone today, but the sounds of Dr. John and James Booker still float down the avenues. John Cleary's new album, Go-Go Juice, which comes out tomorrow, is all about the city and the contributions of the funk and jazz sound to the New Orleans sound. John spent some time in our studio at the piano, which, as we learned, is a window on his soul. His soul, a four-piece jazz band.
Well, you got the drums again, boom, chak, boom, 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 chak, which is like a basic kind of Dixieland groove, and that pulse is 100 years old in New Orleans. Boom, chak, street parade
so
music, and that's
great,
the music
yeah.
you second line to down the street on a Sunday afternoon. Really, funk is an attitude, and it's a kind of a way of approaching rhythm. They call that Paki way in New Orleans, but that same rhythm is all over the Caribbean. You hear Cuban clave, you hear the way calypso music is played in Trinidad. You've got dancehall music in Jamaica uses that same basic pulse. That kind of is like makes you fall from side to side, and that's kind of what makes you want to dance. If it's not funky, people like, don't want to dance to it.
Right.
So you have four beats of a bar, and you might play.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what funk is in the New Orleans context. It's to do with the syncopation. But like I say, they've been doing that for 100 years, for longer, really.
What were you like when you came to New Orleans as
a
greenhorn?
I was a kid, really. I left school early, got a job on a building site to save up money to come to New Orleans with. So I had to get a job, and so I got a job. Very lucky I landed on my feet. I was so lucky in retrospect, but I got a job at the Maple Leaf Bar. And James Booker was the resident piano player. And he also lived upstairs and was in the bar all day, hanging out because he got free drink. And I got a job painting the bar. So he would just sit and play piano to while away the time. And I'd be a few feet away on a ladder with a paintbrush, just soaking it in. And that's what I'd gone there for. I mean, I loved Dr. John's piano playing. And I went to New Orleans. My mission was to try and find out where he learned that stuff from.
Dr. John, did you encounter him shortly after you arrived there? Did you hang with him?
He wasn't living in New Orleans. I'd been there for quite a while, living in New York, I think, at that time.
Yeah.
But then after a while of being in New Orleans, I had to leave. My visa eventually ran out after many extensions. And when I got back to England, funnily enough, I ended up landing a gig playing guitar in his band. He came over to England to do some shows, and I ended up playing guitar in his band. So that's how I got to know him, became friends with him, first of all.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah.
Give me a Dr. John lick.
Well, you know, the basic riff, that the very first riff that I heard that they all use is the basic, you know. I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the thing that really, really suckered me when I first kind of heard it. Mac, when he does that lovely thing with... I loved that.
Is New Orleans still recovering?
Well, you know, it's yes, I suppose is the straight answer, but recovery suggests returning back to normal. So a couple of things. I mean, New Orleans was never normal to start with.
Mm.
The idea that is that people say, is it all fixed up now? And they say, well, it wasn't fixed up before the storm. Everything was completely dysfunctional. So it's not recovering, it's changing. So New Orleans, the big question is, what is New Orleans coming back as? How's the demographic change affecting the culture? And so, I mean, a lot of funky, poor neighborhoods that used to be right in the middle of the city were changed hugely. Treme, part of town called Treme, which was the oldest black neighborhood in the United States, used to be a dangerous place to go to, but it was a risk worth taking, I thought, for the music. You could go on one night, there were five joints within a three-block radius that had brass bands playing funk. And so that's all gone.
Mm.
That's all gone. And a lot of the generation that produced the music that became known around the world as rock and roll, in New Orleans they call it rhythm and blues, in the 1940s and the 50s, that generation of musicians are the guys that I was lucky enough to learn from and play with in their bands when I was a kid. And they're all gone now, pretty much. And a lot of them they were old, but a lot of them, I think their demise was kind of hastened by all the stress and strain of Katrina, the aftermath of Katrina.
When this generation is gone in New Orleans and everything's, you know, recorded and sampleable and, you know, does music sort of leave the street, leave the dirt, leave the earth?
There's always going to be brass bands. I mean, that's alive and well, thank goodness. Even though there was a time when that nearly disappeared, I think for a lot of young people in the 70s, that was considered something pretty hokey and old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tradition that's rooted in the 19th century that's you can still hear
coming
on
back
the street corner. There was a band playing on the street corner down by the French Market on Sunday when I was on my bicycle cycling around. It sounded killer.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that the tradition, the stuff that's been invented in New Orleans in the two big periods, the traditional jazz and rhythm and blues, what the contribution was so huge. You know, the ethnic folk music of New Orleans is funk. I mean, the folk music of New Orleans was so good that it became adopted by cultures all around the world and left an indelible mark on pop music all around the globe, and it's become the world's music now. But that big, that funky kick drum was invented in New Orleans. That funky backbeat, which is the central part of any popular music. They didn't invent it in New Orleans, but it was a much larger part of what they were doing down there. But all that kind of stuff came out of New Orleans. Other people messed with it, but in New Orleans there was this big culture. Changed the way music's played around the world, and that's the people of New Orleans. Mm. And I think really that kind of... We touched on that with one of the songs on the new record. There was a line after the in the song that's on the new album. It was inspired by something that Bonnie Raitt said. I was in Bonnie Raitt's band at the time Katrina happened, and the week afterwards she said something one night that was quite poignant. She said, you know, music, New Orleans music is the greatest gift America gave the world. And so I used that line in the song but extended it to make the point. And the song, the line lyric is, the heartbeat and the soul of the people of the city of New Orleans is the home of the greatest gift America gave the world. It ain't just the city, but it's the heartbeat of the people from that city. It's the people, that's the resource, the artistic resource from which this incredible gift came.
John Cleary's album Go-Go Juice is out tomorrow. To see a video of John performing right here in the Takeaway studio, visit thetakeaway.org. Respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment funkily at thetakeaway.org. If you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news and to keep yourself thinking. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills, like French, filet crochet, and front flips. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.